You're listening to Booth Talk from the Aftermovie Diner, and this episode is a completely different, weird and wonderful special episode. So for people who don't know, Peter Spelos is one of those that guys. He's a character actor and a voiceover artist and an improv comedian, and he's lived a life and been in films big and small and done anime voiceovers and Transformer voiceovers and Cowboy Bebop voiceovers, all sorts of cool stuff. Peter Spelos, the New Yorker, has lived a life. And I have, over the last few years, become good friends with the man on Facebook. He is most well-known in our humble B-movie-loving circles as the wonderful Orville Ketchum from Sorority House Massacre 2 and its sequel, Hard to Die, both directed by Jim Wynorski. Now, we interviewed Jim Wynorski way back a few years ago on this very show, and we talked about those films. I also recorded a musical song all about Orville Ketchum, which I will put at the end of this episode for everyone to revisit. However, it got Peter and I talking, and I'm so glad it did, because jump forward a few years, and I had the unbelievable privilege to go and have a diner breakfast with the man. And it's one of those occasions where you kind of wish you could take the whole world with you to have a diner breakfast with Peter Spelos, because he is engaging and funny and charming and a raconteur and a great person. And he tells us all about his career acting, but also his passion for teaching improv comedy and traveling to both Indiana and the UK. He also talks about his philosophy that we're all taking this shit a bit too seriously, and maybe I'm taking this intro a bit too seriously. Anyway, I just need to set up the fact that this is just a conversation. It goes straight into the conversation with Peter, and it doesn't really end. We have to get up at the end of breakfast and pay the tab and everything, and we leave, but like, the conversation doesn't end. So it's just a conversation without a beginning or an end, but a hell load of middle. There is no end of middle to be entertained and thrilled by as I sit down and have breakfast in the Comfort Diner in Midtown in New York City with none other than the phenomenal Peter Spelos. Come with me, won't you? Sometimes you just need silly. Satire is great, and there's a ton of great satire out there. But sometimes you just
need things.
Silly.
You Brits get silly more than most. You know, you still put on a dress and find that funny.
Oh, yeah.
So do I.
You
know. But my partner,
you and Joe Piscopo, no less.
Thank you very much. And I'm a striking blonde, by the way. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I know.
But seven words. I have a card. I've been sitting on my desk for 40 years. And when I was at WPLJ, and my comedy partner, Jim Brownell, the funniest man in the world, gave me a card and said, never lose this. And I've given it to students. And all the seven words say is, are we taking this shit too seriously? And it's kind of a reminder when, you know, when what's happening in Washington is happening and posturing all over the world, and we look like the stupid bully in the sand in every country we go to. It's like, can we just have a little fun? Can we just put a funny nose on? And so what do? I teach improv and comedy for the rest of my life.
It's awesome. It is awesome. And I think it's completely and utterly needed in a very genuine way, but also in a very silly way, which is what I love about it.
Well, not only are we tasked with being the mirror for society as artists, we can choose the reflection, how we reflect the mirror.
Right.
You know, real or funhouse mirror, you know, we can decide what we want to spoof.
Definitely. But it's interesting because satire is having a boom, but like, silly surreal comedy seems to kind of be still on the fringe.
Well, what happened to silly and comedy, it got in the hands of people like Adam Sandler.
Right.
You know, and which I find, with David Spade, is the unholy trio of comedy. You know, just, oh my God, can that be any less funny than it is right now?
Beyond
that.
How are you?
Hi.
Very good, very good, thank you.
Something
to drink?
Please.
Yes.
It's me. I'm up. Hi. How's your coffee?
Very good and strong.
Just like me and you. You're very good enough. We didn't know which one. Well, then I'll take your very good very strong coffee.
And I'll have a cup of English breakfast tea, please. To play up to the stereotype.
Wanker. You know, it's gonna be twinnings, you know it is.
Yeah,
that's another thing.
As long as
I get my drugs from England then.
Of course.
Oh, I know, I come home with boxes of Yorkshire tea and Jaffa cakes.
Yorkshire gold tea, man, it's the best.
World.
Is it?
No,
it is the best.
No, I knew we'd be fast friends.
Oh, yes.
No,
I have two tubs of Yorkshire gold tea at home.
I have two boxes of 80 count in my cupboard with another 160 waiting in Newcastle to be sent to me closer to Christmas. And Katie Harris, if you're listening, that black currant and lemon jam is changing my life.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And Customs, if you're listening, fuck you. I got it passed.
Customs don't listen to this. Oh, it's a funny story. So when Kim and I were coming back from Paris, going back into England, because weirdly enough, we planned our Paris trip like in the middle of the second week, so we had to do customs twice.
No, you planned the engagement for Paris.
Yeah.
Because you're not an idiot.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't want to touch your phone or have like...
No, it's fine. It's all good. We can...
I'd be more concerned touching him than the phone.
Yeah, exactly. Me?
Whatever you do.
Are you guys ready to order? You need a minute.
One more minute would be great. Okay. Thank you so much.
I also think at some point, we should interview these people over here to annoy them.
Yes. I feel so sorry. They come for their Saturday brunch, and they've got us loudmouths next to them. But that is what it is. It's what happens in New York. You can't help it.
I wish your listeners could see the menu on this, because it just may take me all day to eat here.
Yeah, it may take us all day just to decide what we want. It's incredible. Okay, so here are their brunches and breakfast on the back here. Okay. Thank you. What do I want?
That could be a long list.
I'm always tempted to just go for the lumberjack, just to be a...
a Brit?
Yeah.
Sing the song? First of all, even your commercials on the airlines for British Airlines are star-studded.
Yeah.
You know, no one does their own seatbelt announcement before.
No.
I swear to God, it was Ian McKellen and Rob Brydon and Thandi Newton, or Tandy, I never know how she pronounces that. It just continued.
Oh, here we go. I'm going to have the lumberjack, but instead of the pancakes, I'm going to ask if they can do French toast. That should be fine,
that
right?
Should be nice. If not, I'll go in the kitchen and speak to the chef myself. I have a Brit question to ask you.
Yes,
first of all, I did a Southern Rail joke with my students and got a laugh.
Yes.
Because I watched Brit panel shows so much, I'm up on what's going on.
Yeah.
And now I'm old and I forgot the Brit. Croydon. Why do so many comics make fun of Croydon? First of all, it's the... Hey, sounding word, which if you know the Sunshine Boys by
right.
Simon Kay, are funny.
They're funny.
So it has that sound.
It's there's a lot of places like that. Croydon, Hull is another one.
Is it a blue collar working class town? What are they making fun of?
I think it's just like a dull town.
Okay,
like,
great.
It's just sort of so dull
Jersey.
And dreary. Yes.
What we would call Jersey here.
Yes.
Yeah,
so, and what's it? There's Hull, and then there's the place where the office is set, which is the other one that Stoke-on-Trent, which is another one, because it's just a funny name. Slough. That's
it. We have the best name.
Yeah, we do. We have all the silly names. But then where I grew up down in the home counties, which is all south of London, the Hampshire, Surrey, and Sussex, they have names like Lower Piddle and Upper Piddle.
See, now we're
names
getting like, posh.
It's awesome.
Now we're getting a little posh. Yeah.
A little posh. I was born in Solihull, which is the outskirts of Birmingham, and that is not posh at all.
No, I've been to two conventions at Birmingham.
Have you been to Digbeth Coach Station in
no.
Birmingham? Thank God for that, because it's, you know how all bus depots are just like the worst places on earth? The Digbeth Coach Station might be the very worst, even worse than Port Authority.
Well, that's gotten better over the years.
It has,
that,
much better.
You know, what's the line from Star Wars? A worser city of slime, scum, and villainy. That was 42nd Street for the longest time.
Yes. Well, it often makes me laugh because obviously I like most B-movie fans, have a complete affection and an affinity for sort of the movies that came out at that time. However, I've spoken to a lot of people, Bill Lustig, for example, and Frank Henenlotter and people like that who were obviously making, and James Lickenhouse, who was making movies sort of at that time on 42nd Street. And they all kind of go, oh, it was this halcyon time. And I'm like, I don't know that I want to go to the cinema and be in danger of being, like, stabbed by someone or injected with a hypodermic needle.
Cut to Los Angeles, you know, where would you like some more sushi before the movie, sir? You know,
yeah. Well, no, I just mean that it's wonderful, I think, to watch art about those, like, gritty times and to immerse yourself in it and be part of that without necessarily having to sit on a, you know, a bloodstained or a cum-stained chair.
It's finer, much finer to watch in the comfort of your own home,
right.
Bathroom in the fridge,
yeah.
Mere steps away.
Right, exactly.
Dog on your lap.
Yeah.
Life is good. No, I'm all about comfort these days. I swear to you. I consider myself to be an old Indian chief at this point.
Yeah.
All I want to do at night is sit around a campfire, regale tales of the hunt of the young brave. Hi! You have no idea, right in the middle of a story I'm telling on this. I have to tell the story again.
It's okay.
What is your name? Hi, Alex. Alexander, my middle name.
Really?
Really? I wouldn't make that up. My friend, what are you having?
Could I have the lumberjack with bacon? Instead of the pancakes, could I swap it to French toast? Is that that's awesome. Over easy. That'd be great. Thank you.
How is your breakfast burrito? Is it
very good?
I like very good. I'm particularly fond of very good.
Do you mind me eating it? No?
Yes? Yes, no, yes. Sausage drink, good sausage. You just came from England. How's your sausage?
Sausage drink. You like the sausage drink?
Bacon.
Bacon?
Yeah.
Inside or
on the
side?
The size of a cigar.
What? Inside or on the side?
Oh, no, inside.
Okay.
You know what? And a side of red pine will have to, because I have to get my winter weight going.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Very important.
Thank you so much.
I had to have bacon in honor of your dog.
Of course.
Could just have some. And by the way, this, I had a proper Scottish breakfast made by a Scot.
Oh, you are so lucky. Amazing.
I've never seen so much meat in my life.
Yes.
Everything.
It's revolutionary. And I was looking for a place in Midtown that did an English breakfast. There's one place, the Shakespeare, does it on a Sunday, but they do it in a fancy frou-frou.
No, this
is a thing. Yeah. I couldn't do that.
This was black sausage and tatty scones and it was haggis. Haggis.
Yes.
Listeners, run. No. Get a car and go have haggis.
Go have haggis somewhere.
It is unbelievable. See, I have that English palate.
Definitely.
I love meat, oatmeal, currants. I love kind of, I'm eating like a pig, which is both a metaphor and literal at the same time.
Not at all. It's awesome. I definitely subscribe to that thing of, you know, when it comes to, like, indulgence and eating and things like that, I definitely subscribe to the thing, like, we all go sometime. Like, we might as well enjoy it while we're here and eat the good things while we're here.
There's a comic that said, and I don't know who the comic is, and I apologize, I'm not still in the line. If I remember, I'll footnote it. Who said, my doctor says, basically, if I exercise and I work really hard, I'll add 5 years of my life.
Yeah.
Problem is, it's the last 5 years.
It's the last five years. And Bill Hicks said,
by the way, 87 to 92, I'm not interested in.
Bill Hicks said it's the 5 years at the end of your life when you're being pushed around by your born-again Christian son in a wheelchair. Like, you know what I mean?
Maybe the Hicks is lying.
Yeah. But no, it was, someone has said it again recently, but like Hicks said, there's something about, being pushed around and da-da-da. It's like it's the bit at the end when you're like soiling yourself. And
this
you have
generation doesn't have that voice.
No.
The last...
Like I say,
Sam Kinison and Bill Hicks were the last voices of a generation that were, I take it from the Peter Finch network, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Everything's gotten too PC. It's funny, in a world where Nazis and the NRA is popular again, in the same breath, they're saying, well, you got to be more PC. Really?
Yeah, I don't understand it.
Nothing more PC about a Nazi flag or a Confederate flag.
Right, exactly.
You know,
it's maddening because
the word, like, we want it to be less PC, especially nowadays, when you hear that in, like, focus groups with Republicans and stuff, they go, well, we don't like how PC everything is. And what they mean is they want to be able to say words that they shouldn't be saying in the first place. Right. But that means that when you and I say it, I know what you mean when you say it, and you know what I mean when I say it. We don't mean, like, that we want to be able to say words we shouldn't be able to say. We just want to be able to laugh and make jokes.
You know, you'd not screw with you.
Right.
It's like if I called you a wanker.
Right.
You know, are you right? No, he's not. Don't worry. He's not.
Not right now. Both hands above the table, and I'm not that ambidextrous.
But it's... Lenny Bruce said it's intent. It's how you use the word.
Yes.
There are no such thing as dirty words. It's the intent of everything. And what's happening is they're wielding the PC letters with intent, like it's a sword sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, and I have a problem with anything that goes to the right and the religious right. If you want to tell me this is the way I got to feel, you know,
yeah,
my pinko New York commie English atheist comes out of me, and it's like, oh, do tell. I'm so ready. I'm rolling up my shirt sleeves. I'm so interested.
Yes.
You know?
No, completely. And I'm with you all the time.
Rule number two in life. You ask any one of my students or friends what rule number two is, and they know that I tell them, nice is not funny.
Right.
There's no way you can be nice and funny.
No.
By the way, rule number one is smell it first, and that works everywhere.
Everywhere.
Trust me.
Every time.
But nice and funny do not equate.
Not at all. You have to...
Yeah, you got nothing wrong with being nice.
You have to be mean to be... Not mean, but you have to be... all humor, John Cleese says...
Totally be kind.
All humor is about the negative in life.
Yes.
Should, like, what does he say? Show me a sitcom about Francis of Assisi and I'll show you a dud. Like, that's the thing he said.
Again, not enough John Cleese in your lives. There's not enough...
I like
silliness. Two Ronnies. Here's, I know. We can talk about the two Ronnies, which nobody knows.
Right.
Which, thank God for PBS, I got a sniff of after a Monty Python, because that's where they would show, that's where we would get the episodes
a
year later. And I knew that the Brits were funnier than us. You're nicer than us. You're politer than us. You're more sexually repressed than we are.
Oh,
which
way
is
more.
Saying a lot. And you're funnier than us, which is why every time I go to London, I'm at home. I have a friend of mine. She was a student of mine at 21, 34. She's Lauren Brock, I love you, is a production manager for movies.
Yeah.
She came to one of my classes, and Lauren was always I could check in with Lauren. She would tell me like it is, because she was a Southern girl. And I go, how'd I do? And she goes, you have no filter anymore, do you? I go, no, not a screen, not a one.
No.
I used to have a small filter with my students.
Yeah. Yeah, not at all.
But I owe that to them. I owe it to myself to be the most authentic me I can be. And at this time in my life, at 63, it so doesn't matter to me if you like me. I care if you do.
Right.
But the distinction of, it don't matter to me if you give a shit.
Right.
And you don't like my language? Oh, look, the door's open.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know? So, I'm me. This is it.
Good.
And if you ask my students, I'm the same schmuck you wanted an autograph from that you and I are sitting at the diner. I haven't changed. What changed is I'm older, fatter, and slower. I need more help on certain occasions. But you know what? I'm in London twice a year. I'm teaching in Indiana 9 times a year.
Yeah.
I'm doing conventions. I live in Westchester. I'm on the government cheese at this point, you know,
right,
to help me. I get in the movies half price on Wednesdays because I'm a senior. Fucking problem is I have no idea when it's Wednesday. So this is my life right now.
That's fantastic. And I have to say, this is...
I have to say one thing.
Oh, go ahead.
Very kind people sitting right next to us. We're doing an interview here. And there are two wonderful people just sitting here and are listening to us. And I feel so bad that we've interrupted their breakfast.
I'm so sorry for ruining your brunch.
We are doing a podcast.
It's not ruined our breakfast.
Oh, and they're two Brits? Are we hearing British accents?
Oh, well, thank
you. Wonderful. He's an Anglophile, and I'm originally from England. So, fantastic.
I teach improvisational comedy and acting. I've been doing it in this city 40 years ago. I was a member of the First Amendment Improv Company in New York in 1977.
Nice.
Crikey, I'm old.
That
happens.
What I was going to say was that this is definitely an interview of firsts, because I've never been to this diner before. I've never done an interview in a diner before. I've done plenty of podcasts, but I've never done an interview.
Fabulous.
The first time I've ever talked to yourself in person. So it's lots of wonderful first people.
You and
we've already been going 20 minutes. We haven't even started.
If you and I met in a bar with not knowing anything, we'd be exchanging numbers and hanging out with friends and girlfriends in a minute.
Definitely.
So ask away. I'm
no, I was liking that it was sort of free flowing. But I was so you were talking about starting as an improv comedian here in the city.
Right.
So was that your sort of first? Passion, first love, first thing?
I found that I was funny in ninth grade when I realized that I wasn't athletic, I wasn't pretty, but if you made the girls laugh, they loved you.
Right.
It was like, holy shit, keys to the kingdom.
Yeah.
Well, I had a raison d'etre. I had a reason to live. Make girls laugh, they like hang out with you. So little did I know that I had a dormant passion for acting and performing and did the plays in high school and went to college and got a BFA degree and spent 90 of my 128 credits in theater. I was on stage all the time. Had comedy partners through high school, different couple of partners. And stand-up as a monologist didn't ever appeal to me. Laurel and Hardy appealed to me. Abbott and Costello, Marx Brothers, a comedy of real situation comedy.
Yeah.
But sitcoms actually began as a comedy of situation. And I got to New York and had breakfast this year.
Breakfast?
Oh, that's a beautiful thing. We're going to put it right in the middle so my friend can have some too.
Thank you so much. Look at that. I got it.
Senor. Cholula? Oh, beautiful. Cholula is hot sauce for you English listeners.
Tabasco.
No, Cholula if you have it. I'll tell you, you know I love Tabasco. And see, improv, you're flexible. That's
it's yes and.
Yes and, it is. Right? Does it have vinegar? Is it hot? And by the way, malt vinegar on chips? Fantastic.
Oh, isn't it the best?
I know.
Have you ever been, I was going to ask, since you became such an Anglophile, have you ever been down to Tea and Sympathy in the Village?
No.
So, there is an English-run, it's set up like a post-war cafe with like little like jazz playing in the background and whatever, but it's a British-run cafe.
If you could see how big my eyes are right now.
In the Village, they do English breakfast, but they also do like meat pies and all that, and they have another fish and chip shop on the side of it called Salt and Battery, and they do fish and chips with malt vinegar and everything.
When are we going? Is all I can say about that.
Well, because it's not near Grand Central, I didn't plan it for this morning.
Next time. Oh.
But next time, I will be more than happy to take you. It's just it'll be a cab ride down to West.
Not a problem. I'm 63, and all I want to do is find a nice English girl.
And settle down.
And settle down. We can cook and make things together, and I'll make you laugh, and you can make me lunch. How's that? How's that for a deal?
I think that's a great deal.
Anyway,
so
back to acting and show business.
So you were doing improv in New York.
Yeah, I found improv
and monologuing
at a company. An ad in the paper said take an improv class. I'd done it before. Within a month, I was in the main company performing.
Yeah,
improv and I are like peanut butter and jelly. You know, who knew that I did that? I was that facile to it because my filter that I don't have anymore was even small at 23. But I knew that as a comic, I was fearless.
Yeah.
Fearless. Changed my life and my career throughout decades and decades. Had no clue that at some point I would teach it, not as a lifestyle, but as a way to get free from the shackles of your own life.
Right.
And using it as a tool as much to teach a skill set, but kind of how to live.
Yeah, so you know, therapy yes and, as well, right?
Well, I hate to call it therapy, but it's sort of an approach to freedom, you know? Yes, and don't ask a lot of questions. Be on time. Have fun when you get there. Stop whining, you know?
Stop whining.
Forget what just went wrong. It just went wrong a second ago.
Yeah.
Stay present. Look her in the eyes. Tell her how you feel. Change your life.
Yeah.
You start to do that, have to be interested in your students. I'm so interested in their lives. I don't worry about being interesting. My coach, Barbara Deutsch, used to say, if you're interested, you're interesting.
Yeah.
But if you try and be interesting, they ain't interested. So my life changed when I really realized I want to be interested in what I know, and I want to be interested in what I don't know, and I want to be interested in what I don't know I don't know.
Right.
Holy shit, I never thought about penguins in Wyoming. Let me read about that.
Right.
Wow, I hate penguins in Wyoming. I'll read something else.
Penguins in Wyoming, not my thing.
TikTok, John. I'm 63. No two ways about it. I got more yesterdays than tomorrows. I got a lot of friends who hate when I say that. But guess what? I do.
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to miss today.
No.
So when today's
enjoy
yesterday,
it.
Then I got another one in the chamber. Tomorrow comes up, you know?
Of course.
So I really screwed that whole metaphor and up. That was just hideous.
So,
go ahead.
Apart from your voiceover work that you were telling me earlier, because on your resume or on IMDb, the earliest credits are voiceover credits, but they're for anime films, and you're saying you kind of did that in retrospect. You did that.
In redub.
Right.
My California career didn't start till 89, till I moved out there. But the stuff I was doing in New York was morning comedy team on WPLJ and improv and plays, and I was directing.
Right.
So I was working, but I left everything at 35 to have half the life I said I was always going to have.
So what made you make that trip? Like, if you had...
Aside from the police? I knew the ground wasn't fertile anymore. I was married and it wasn't working out, and I would say that's 80% my fault. I had not dealt with issues in the past in my own family. And I had not had my TV and film career.
And that's what you were really looking for at that point. That's what you were interested in.
And I swear to God, I had a dream, and I had a series of dreams. My friend in the lovely and talented Jay Howard used to say, my celebrity guest star dreams. So I worked with Bruce Willis with the First Amendment.
Right.
If I knock your coffee up, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you for being kind. And I worked with Bruce, very talented First Amendment. We know Bruce's story. But Bruce would come to me in dreams every once in a while, and we'd have discussions about show business. It's the weirdest fucking thing. And one night he came to me in a dream. My marriage wasn't working. My nightclub was, comedy club that I was running was kind of closing, going through a lot of transition. And he came to me in a dream with Sybil Shepherd at the bar, who was his co-star in Moonlighting. And just stood there and looked at me in the dream and said, you got to go to Los Angeles. He says, you got to go. And I'm like, what? He goes, you're funnier than I am. He says, look at the career I'm having. He says, you got to get out there. That's where you're going to work. I said, really? He says, trying to leave New York. I swear to God. I woke up that morning, and 3 weeks later, I was in Los Angeles. 3 weeks after that, I moved. I knew what I had to do. It wasn't working. I had to go, and it was now.
And Bruce Willis told you that in a dream, from the Moonlighting set.
Yeah. No, from Who's On First, the nightclub, my comedy club.
Right.
In a dream, we were in the club hanging out.
Nice. But you knew him back in New York?
When we were doing comedy at the First Amendment. But I knew it wasn't really Bruce in my dream.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I'm a Freudian. I knew that was me.
Right, of course.
Talking to me, going, get the fuck out of New York. The ground isn't fertile here anymore.
Right.
And at the time, the New York Knicks were a terrible basketball team. And Michael Ray Richardson was a great player who never lived up to his potential. And when he asked them about the Knicks in the future, he said four words that were on the back of the post. And he went, the ship be sinking. And I woke up one morning and thought, the ship be sinking.
Yeah.
And I left everything I knew. I loaded up the truck and I moved to Beverly, as they sang.
And a lot of that was happening in New York at the time. I mean, the 80s became a really sort of rough time of transition of everything kind of shutting down before the sort of boom again in the mid to late 90s, right? Because a lot of comedians, when they talk about the comedy club set, they talk about sort of the end of the 70s, early 80s.
Mid 80s. When I was at Who's On First, 84, 85, 86, we were in the middle of it.
Right.
I had a 55-seat room that had some of the best talent in the city that wasn't getting on the bigger stages because there wasn't a lot of opportunity, but there was a lot of smaller clubs like mine that allowed great new talent that you might not know to work.
Right.
And we had 15 bucks and catch a rising star. They'd call us up and say, you got room for four, we're packed. They would send us audience.
Nice.
Knowing that it's the same comic and the work was great.
Yeah.
So it certainly was the halcyon days of doing comedy in New York. You know, it was also the cocaine days. And
yeah.
And you should only know those stories, but...
So you head out to...
Head out to L.A. in 89.
And then your first credit that I'm aware of is the now legendary Sorority House Massacre 2, where you invent, for me, one of the greatest, like, commentaries on slasher films with a great sense of humor that's sort of been in the sense that you're this unkillable thing and the audience is like, wait a minute, he's just trying to help, but at the same time the audience is saying, why doesn't he just say something? Like, it's this
whole, because he's too dumb and slow.
It's just this wonderful, like, commentary on what was going on.
You know,
it's hilarious.
That we can raise Orville to that level is amazing.
No, we can. I think we can.
It was
slasher movies are down here anyway, and I don't mean that as an insult, I mean that as a compliment, but to have that, what is set up as essentially a titty slasher flick, to have Orville in there, I suddenly realized the genius.
Jim, and it's the genius of Jim Wynorski.
Right.
Jim and I, when I went to the audition at New Horizon, that a manager had got me, I was really new to the town, and I walked into the building, and there was, I don't know, 37 scantily clad women and me. I knew two things. I'm in the right place, and I'm in the right place.
Yeah.
I walked into the audition, and it was for Jim and Julie Corman, Roger's wife. He said, any questions? And I went, yeah, this line, Ketchum, Orville Ketchum. I said, that's really like Bond, James Bond, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he looked at me and laughed. And he said, all right, I got an idea of something. And I did, which now I called infamously the Thorazine Shuffle.
Yeah.
That sort of was that walk of heavy legs, that if you're on a little lot of drugs, many people might call it method acting, you know. And that kind of dead stare and that kind of being a New Yorker. And I say this to all my friends from the South in Texas. We think a Southern accent sound a little stupid every once in a while. It's like the posh and the cockney. It's the same thing.
Right.
You know? So I made Orville just a little slow, you know, like he was just on a little Thorazine and kind of just did the dead stare that Michael Caine and Hannibal Lecter used to talk about. Never left the eyes, and just kind of stayed there, and not a problem. You don't know that. I've been looking at John for the last 40 seconds, never blinking.
And it's terrifying to know what to do in those occasions.
God,
except lean over and kiss you, maybe.
Yeah. And another thing I love about the English. Jim went berserk when he almost chased me out of the room. Who are you? And this is fantastic. Booked the movie. We did it in six or seven days on a pre-existing set, on a bet with Roger Corman that Jim had. He couldn't do a movie in 7 days while Roger's on vacation. But what solidified Jim and I in sort of this working partnership, and thank God because of Jim, it became Fred Olen Ray, it became Richard Gabay, and I met these wonderful, wonderful people. Jim was tearing into some poor grip or gaffer at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was cold. We were shooting in the back of the Corman's lot in Venice. And as you know, Venice, you know where the big ballerina clown is down by the Rose Cafe?
I do, yeah.
Which was surreal enough to begin with. He is lacing into this guy. And it's, then it comes a beat where it's dead silent. And I start doing this applauding. I go, And I go, ladies and gentlemen, Jim Wynorski. And the Jim Wynorski dancers be right out, stay with us. The whole place exploded with laughter. And Wynorski turned on me. But not turned like a dog would turn. Turned to kind of smile and like, wow. You know, we had a moment.
Yeah.
Like, you're a big dog who barks. I'm a big dog who barks.
Right.
Let's hang out and bark together.
Right.
That was it. Fast friends, all of a sudden, you know, are we taking this shit too seriously?
Yeah.
Was the line that comes to my mind. But that's what kind of cemented with Jim. I had no clue that this would be at the level that someday, when I was dealing with a drug habit, trying to get home to my mom who was slowly losing to dementia, that some kid man would offer me $300 for the Orville shirt to help me get back home to my mom. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The community of you folks who love what we did, like the Transformers community that continues to show me more love than I truly deserve, blows me away that you loved what we did so much. And I'm honored to kind of look back at my career and say, you know what? I didn't get that Oscar, but boy, did I get a John and a Terrence and a Bob and a Fred and a Susan and 1,000 people I call my friend. I won.
Yeah.
I won.
Definitely. I mean, in a totally similar emotion, but a completely obviously different set of things. It's the same with the show and the website and all the sort of stuff that I do creatively. It's that we don't have millions of people listening. No one's coming to me to give me advertising, blah, 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 blah. But I've met a thousand people around the world. I have friends in all these different countries. It's made dreams come true in terms of, like, the people I've met, the people I've interviewed, the people I've... Like, I never thought in a million years that I would, A, be saying, talking to you in a diner, but talking to Michael Ironside while he drove back from Tennessee to Baltimore, speaking to Clint Howard, and he's...
You spoke to Darkseid?
I spoke to Ironside, yes.
Well, doesn't he play Darkseid in one of the Superman cartoons? Isn't he the voice of...
He might be. We didn't talk about his voiceover work. We only talked about... He had just done a film about the California housing crisis. And he was a very small little film that sort of nobody really saw at the time. And he was trying to promote it. It was the only way I could, like... He wasn't doing podcasts for anyone else other than this movie.
That's great.
And I got in touch with... But I just mean it sort of allowed me to have this, like, weird existence that has... brought so many wonderful people into my life. So when you say it brought all these wonderful people, I totally understand what you mean in terms of it might not be Oscar worthy, but it's brought you riches.
Work beyond my dreams.
Yeah.
Working on a Jim film, we're working on Fred Olin Ray. It was like a theater company. I understood it's a group of people with a common cause.
Yeah.
It was like doing a play. You knew each other, you worked together, you laughed together, you ate together. There was no, this is the actor's table, this is the crew table.
Yeah.
It's like, sit down, what's your name? Hi, I'm Pete. You know?
So I was going to ask, because you were in the Fred Olin Ray movie, Attack of the 60-Foot Centerfold, and so was my buddy George Stover from Baltimore. Did you work with George?
What a kind, sweet man.
Isn't he a lovely guy?
Oh,
I love George Stover.
He's terrific. Yeah, I worked with George in that movie.
Good. I'm glad.
John Lazar and Debbie Dutch and Michelle Bauer, and it was, I loved that film because it was really silly.
Yes.
And Fred let me be really silly.
But no, I wondered if there was a Stover and Spellos connection, so I'm glad that there was. That's fantastic.
There is. I probably have a picture of George and I together from that movie. Like, when you posted all the Orville pictures this morning, I went, well, let me show him a couple of them.
No, I was glad. Yeah, so one of the pictures you posted that you said you had stories about was working on Heartbreakers with Sigourney Weaver.
I did two episodes of a show called Get a Life.
Right.
With Chris Elliott. Chris Elliott was the man under the stairs for David Letterman.
Oh, yeah, no.
Lineage is show business royalty. His father, Bob Elliott, was part of Bob and Ray comedy team, which in New York was as big as they get in the 40s or 50s on radio.
Right.
These were heroes of mine. I did the show twice. I got to meet Bob Elliott. Chris is a stand-up guy. David Merkin is the director.
Right.
David Merkin calls me in for Heartbreakers. Now, I had no idea that Sigourney and Jennifer Love Hewitt was in the movie, because I worked with Love when she was 12.
Right, in one of Winovsky's movies. A
couple of them. Munchie and Munchie Goes Home. And
Family.
Little Miss Millions.
Little Miss Millions. Yeah, right. Sorry, yes.
I'll give you the connecting Jennifer Love Hewitt story after this.
Okay.
But you're just going to get me back on point, because
Sigourney Weaver and Heartbreak.
Right, I'll forget what story I'm telling, because I hate being old.
It's okay.
Jewel Bestrip was the casting director. Merkin was a great guy and brought me in for sort of a shyster lawyer.
Yeah.
I did the audition and he said, "So will you read something else for me?" He had that face like, "I love you, but it's not going to work." And so I improvised a couple lines of dialogue. He said, "Can you look at this?" I said, "Yeah, I don't need to go out." He said, "Go out for 5 minutes." He's like, "I'm ready to go. What do you need right now?" Basically, I had to improvise carrying a statue that had a erect penis that we wind up snapping off in the movie. You see the scene. Got a big laugh, David Castor. I get to the set. She's the most elegant woman I've ever met in my life. Alabaster skin, my height, drinking a cup of tea on a saucer. She could not be more elegant. And I spent most of the day flirting with her nose to nose in this scene.
Yeah.
And the only thought in my mind is Ripley. Because I'm flirting with Ripley.
One of the greatest women on the planet.
She was elegant. She was wonderful. I had just done a bit in a Wynorski film with Stevie Franken.
Right.
From Dobie Gillis.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
In a Russian accent. Sigourney's doing a Russian accent in this movie. So between takes, she and I are joking around, speaking in Russian accent, having fun time. She's just a lovely, elegant woman, talking about her husband's theater company, Raw. Ricky Jay is there, too.
Yeah.
Ricky Jay, the guy with the cards. Ricky Jay, the 52 assassins.
The magician, yeah.
And it was a kind of quiet moment. They're resetting, and I look at Sigourney, and I went, "Can I ask you a question, actor to actor?" She goes, "Of course." She wasn't expecting this next moment. I went, "In Galaxy Quest." And she rolled her eyes and said, "No, stay with me on this." I said, "In that moment with Tim Allen that you're running through the ducks and you say, 'Ducks, why is it always ducks?'" I said, "I'm an improv actor." I said, "Did you improvise that?" And she kind of looked at me and she said, "Yeah, I did it in rehearsal. And they loved it so much we kept it in." I said, "I knew it." I said, "It was brilliant, and you don't need me to tell you that, but it was so referential of your whole career." And I said, "I loved it."
Yeah.
She was very gracious. And Sigourney Weaver. So Jennifer Love Hewitt, in that same movie.
Yes.
Never got to see Love. I'm shooting on different days.
Right.
And back when I knew her, she was Love Hewitt.
Right.
She was a 12-year-old girl. That was the name she went by. There was always affection. I knew her mom. I would run into at wherever I would run in. "Hi, how are you?" Big hugs and kisses.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a show, which if you ever ask the questions, "What's the best thing you ever did in your career?" It would be American Dreams on NBC, that I got to do 30 episodes over 3 years at the beginning of this century, for Jonathan Prince and a hell of a man, the producer and creator of the show. She's coming on as Tina Sinatra.
Right.
She's coming on in the bandstand segment, which was not my segment, but I played Gus, the director of bandstand. So I knew I would see her. Well, I'm hanging out with a group of the extras, because I always hung out with the extras, because my peeps.
Right.
I was an extra in Saturday Night Fever. That was my first movie, so. And these ultimately became a lot of my students. And about 20 yards away is a group of producers talking. I'd rather hang out with labor than management. That's just me.
Of course. Yeah.
Well, I see Love start walking down her Tina Sinatra dress, you know, within a handler.
Yeah.
And she smiles and she starts running. And the producers think she's running to them,
yeah,
to the group. She starts running. She runs into my arms. And, of course, the entire producers group is like, "How are you?
What does he have that we don't?"
History.
History, right?
I knew her when she was 12. How's right. your mom? How's your grandma?
Of course.
I looked at her and I went, "Baby, you are amazing." I said, "Look what you've done."
Yeah.
I said, "You deserve every ounce of this."
Yeah.
She was great. During the song, when they would do it in the booth, she would kind of turn to the booth, look at me and sing. And the extra standing next to me went, did Jennifer just, I don't know if you would just look at you and sing, and I went,
yeah. Yeah. Happens all the time.
Of course.
Look at me.
What's wrong with you?
Exactly. Look at me.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I'm 300 pounds of beauty, baby.
Damn right.
So that's my connecting Sigourney Jennifer Love Hewitt. But I never and never will forget the movies that I could cut my teeth into as a 35-year-old that gave me the ability to then do the bigger stuff because I was so comfortable on a set.
Right.
I was a stage actor. I was a comic. But I had to learn the technique of film. And if it wasn't for Jim Wynorski and Fred Olen Ray and then Rich Grabeye, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to do 20 movies my first 3 years in California.
And it's always funny, the Jennifer Love Hewitt story and things like that, but, you know, I love, almost more than their kind of later, more professional work, I love, like, the movies that big stars, like, started off in.
Like what?
You know what I mean? So we just did a before he was famous George Clooney episode back in January, and the movies are completely different, but it was, like, Return of the Killer Tomatoes he did. He did an awful heist movie called Red Surf, which is just terrible.
I know Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. I remember the first one.
He's in the sequel. And then what else did he do that was that we covered? I forget off the top of my head. But then you've got Cutting Class with Brad Pitt. You've got Helen Hunt was in the Trancers series with Tim Thomason, another guy who got a start in comedy.
Right.
Jennifer Love Hewitt was in Munchies. I just find, like, B-movies, sometimes you're watching a B-movie or whatever, and you suddenly realize that they're actually completely littered with people who ended up being, you know, much bigger.
The greatest B-movie of the 80s?
For me?
Yeah.
The greatest B-movie of the 80s.
That's not a B-movie?
I mean, probably, like, my favorite, like, 80s horror movie or whatever is Evil Dead 2.
All right. But favorite 80s movie?
Favorite 80s movie. Of any...
I'll tell you mine.
Okay.
Big Trouble in Little China.
That's fantastic.
I found that movie on a VHS when there was such a thing as video stores where you pick up...
I mean, Carpenter, throughout the 70s and 80s, hands down one of my favorite directors, probably my top three, John Carpenter is incredible.
Well, The Thing...
You've got The Thing, Big Trouble, In the Mouth of Madness. The one that no one ever talks about is Prince of Darkness, which is incredibly weird and wonderful.
Here's a Thing story for you. I'm having dinner at Wynorski's house with Fred Olen Ray one night. You want to watch a movie? Watch it with Jim and Fred.
Yeah.
With the visions of film directors. We watch The Thing, the original.
Yeah.
And they're gushing and marveling over it. With, you know, the way it should be. But explaining how this movie can't be made today. Because everything's shot in master. The dialogue is overlapping. And it's brilliant. You watch the scene and you think, wow, that's right. That's been the same shot for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That camera hasn't moved. So you couldn't do any of that today.
And is that because they were probably all theatrically trained actors back in the day? It's more...
There's a sense of stage actors back in the day
that
I don't think movies and TV are getting now.
No. And it's also great, like, the few modern movies where directors insist on rehearsal. Like, some bigger directors can sit down and go, I need a month for rehearsal. I don't care. Take it out of the budget. Figure it out.
Which the way it should be.
Definitely.
Because... I don't know if the fans know, you get cast in something, even as a guest star, you don't see any of these actors till you hit the set. And you're lucky if you get a rehearsal for camera.
Right.
They want you to do just what you did at the audition. They're not concerned with product.
Yeah, it's crazy.
They hired you for something. They want you to hit the marks, be on time, do it, so they can move on.
Yeah.
It's nothing like we get to rehearse and talk about the character. No. You gotta jump on a moving train, steal the money, and jump off.
But what seems crazy about it is you would think, because one of the reasons why a lot of people like to do the rehearsal, apart from obviously character development and everything else, is that when you come to shoot it, it's so much quicker, because you're not then confronted with, if you have to block something when you're shooting, or if you have to, like, plan how you're going to do it, so on, it seemed would actually save money if you sort of did a bit of rehearsal.
Well, because you could shoot it quicker. They do it for camera and lighting, so you know exactly what's going to happen. Then they rehearse without you.
Right.
and a second team that comes in with your name on it, the spring,
right,
who's your size, they can light it correctly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then you're not brought in until you are ready to shoot.
Right.
So everything is camera ready.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You might get one pass at it, last looks, and if it's a Jim or Fred movie, we got 72 setups. Get this fucking right in the mask.
Yeah. What did you think? Because I interviewed Jim a while back, but what did you think of the documentary about him? Like, how fair was that, or how unfair was that? Like, what was your feeling on that, the Papatopoulos documentary?
I think, like anything, it's a point of view. No one knows how much Jim loves the movies. Jim loves the movies.
Yeah.
There wouldn't be a thing he wouldn't do. And Jim created the career he wanted.
Yeah.
And aside from being a big dog who barked a lot on the set, because when you work with actors, I actually think the more talented the actor you work with, the more relaxed Jim was.
Yeah.
Because when you work with people who are a sandwich tray of a picnic,
yeah,
but look good in a towel, and that's not everybody. Jim does not know gender. Jim knows everybody.
No, I get it.
That I think that would anchor. Jim once said the perfect movie is post-production.
Yeah.
For me. That's the perfect film for me.
Yeah.
Everything's in post.
Yeah.
I think he's an introvert who does an extroverted career. I think most of us in the entertainment business are introverted who found the avenue to come out and play.
Yeah.
But look, my best night, when I go home tonight, I'd be in my underwear with a cup of Yukon Gold, perhaps a little imbibement, and watching the Yankees, watching a ball game. And I'm thrilled.
Yes.
At the end of the day.
I'll be thrilled if they win.
No, please. Let's not even discuss that.
Yeah, no, right?
I think Jim and Fred always did what they love, and it was a joy to work. It was a joy.
Yeah.
I never had a shitty time working on one of their movies.
No.
Ever. Ever.
That's and he was, like, again, you know, there's a lot made about him, but, like, when I spoke to him, he seemed like an absolutely lovely guy. Direct, like a lot of people are direct, but, I mean, that's absolutely
He's
fine.
A New Yorker.
Yeah, right.
Of course you're direct.
That's
right. Long Island boy. You can't get shit from anybody.
I agree. It's the best way. And it's funny. I think that it's a great... if you come from the UK or London and then come to New York... From my experience, which is obviously going to be different, but like you find that actually New Yorkers, I think, are very nice because in London, people are really miserable. And well, I don't mean that in a...
No, they don't mean they're miserable.
They're miserable, yeah. We were grumpy, gray, but we love it. We find so much humor in being grumpy.
I swear to you, I got off the plane. I left here last Wednesday. It was 85 degrees of humor. Not fat people weather, I assure you. I got off the plane. It was cool.
Yeah.
It was rainy. People were grumpy.
Yeah.
And I went...
I'm home.
I went and loved it. Yeah. Like Ernie Hudson, I love this town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was right at home.
Yeah.
They're grumpy because it's cold and rainy all the time. My friend Catherine Bacon, how are you, darling? Well, I just spoke to her in Leeds this morning. She said, well, winter's here. And I'm like, we're 2.5 weeks in autumn.
Yeah.
But no, that's the British winter's here. Might as well.
Yeah, we haven't had any sun. We had 3 days of sun in June, but it didn't come near us. But that's what I love about it. Like, it's funny, when I watch something like Curb Your Enthusiasm or whatever, I'm always on Larry's side. Like, everyone else is on everyone else's side, and they're all laughing at him. I'm on his side, being like, no, they are idiots.
The difference between Larry and you guys is you apologize for being grumpy. I had counted in my class. They kept apologizing when they would do something wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
26 times.
It's a tick. It's like a vocal tick. I do it all the time as well.
Kids now
like,
they know, I just throw up fingers.
Yeah.
If they apologize while they're acting, they'll just see 7. You know, don't know how many times they have apologized. Yeah. And you know what? Nicest fucking people in the world.
It's a hard habit to break, but yeah. But it is funny. Like,
here's one more thing. I'm sorry.
No, please.
That's chronological. What we don't get in this country either is the proximity of other countries. With all this asshole Trump is doing, we couldn't have picked better neighbors in Mexico and Canada. One country doesn't want us to come over, and the other country doesn't want us to come over.
Right.
Leave us alone, we're fine.
Yeah.
In Europe, you guys have been killing each other for a couple thousand years.
Yeah.
You gotta talk about where the deserts are. They've been killing each other for 5,000 years. But the comedy with the kids, first of all, some of the kids sound exactly like John Cleese.
Yeah.
So it has this Monty Python sound of teaching.
Yeah.
And they do nothing but bang on the French and the Germans. And it makes me laugh because you don't hear bang on the French and the Germans humor
right.
in America.
No.
But you get to England, no, sometimes there was some moke, God, I hate the French.
Well, because in 1066, the French wandered over and conquered us, and we've never forgiven them.
No, blame it on Bill. You know what I mean?
And then, obviously, the Germans had the wars, but what really gets British necks up, it seems, with the Germans is the football. Because we haven't won a European Cup in fucking 50 years.
But you're still annoyed. See, while of the
generations
a thousand years later, you're still annoyed.
Still annoyed.
And that kind of commitment, I can get behind. You know, fuck this, I've been in existence 200 years crap in America. I drive past the Thames, and you get the London Eye.
Yeah.
And then you get the Tower of London,
yeah.
where we've been torturing folks since 1065.
Yes. Let's take you in there and show you all the instruments right. we used.
But 1,000 years.
Yeah, 1,000 years.
Talk to me in history. I'll be dead, but in 800 years, America, talk to me about history.
Oh,
by the way,
go ahead.
Comfort Diner.
Yes.
214 East 45th Street.
Yes.
Fantastic food.
Fantastic
Come
breakfast.
Down here.
Yeah.
Great breakfast.
I love that lumberjack breakfast.
I'm still kind of picking at the corned beef hash here.
I had some of it. It's delicious. The corned beef is fantastic.
Yeah.
You very generously said that I could share it, so I just went ahead and did it. I figured that's how we do it here.
I don't understand people who don't share food. Poster from the 60s. Two cats on the poster. Said, if I had two dead mice, I'd give you one. That's how I've lived my life.
Yeah.
If I have $1,000, you need 500, it's yours. I only have 10, but you need 5, it's yours.
Right.
I don't get a plate of hash so I can eat.
No.
I get a plate of hash so we can eat.
Well, it was very lovely.
And that's New Yorker. That's English. That's, we share. That's, a, you know,
yep.
that's Italian families. That's Jewish families. You put the plate of food everybody eats.
We were just
I don't think America is doing a lot of inclusive anymore.
No.
This is mine. You can't have any. What do you, don't fucking look at this. You know. What, don't look at my food. You know, that kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I hate the idea. People ask me where I'm from. I never say America. I say New York.
Yeah.
And they go, are you from America? I go, from New York.
Yeah.
Please understand the distinction.
Yes. Don't necessarily.
I happen, New York happens to reside within America, but this Americans, your vision of us still in cowboy hats in the old West, you know, still how Brits see Americans. Americans just, no.
No, West.
Where are you going with that? What's wrong with you? Maybe in your skinny world you're done. If you want some, I'll share it with you. Come on, sit in here. I don't mind. I wish you could have seen that repartee with the waiter who wanted to take my food.
Don't come between Peter and
us. No, at a sandwich, don't.
No. But no, so I would say there's a couple of things. My friend
is
a...
Do you want me to take this plate out of your way?
Sure. So I'm not going to reach the other plate easier. No, I'm fine.
Do you want to take your fork?
Sure. He's my friend. He's no better than me.
So one of my friends is a huge Cowboy Bebop fan. And looking through your resume last night, I didn't realize you had done voices on Cowboy Bebop.
Mary Elizabeth McGlynn.
But you did it on the TV series and in the movie.
Yeah, she was a director. She's a dear friend of mine.
Right.
Would always bring me in with a weird. I don't know why I always got the weird role.
Well, the weird role.
Maybe they probably knew who I am. And then Mary brought me in to do a Russian voice on the television, and basically Harvey Fierstein.
Right.
A transsexual, hello darling, can I help you kind of guy. This guy kind of here, you know?
Yeah.
That was the thing. It's a wonderful short story by Kurt Vonnegut called Who Am I This Time?
Yeah.
If you've never read it, read it.
Okay.
It's in a book called Welcome to the Monkey House, a short story. But I would walk into anything. I didn't need to know. I'd book stuff and didn't ask what it was.
Right.
Because I wanted to walk in and go, who am I this time? You hired me because you know I have a certain skill set.
Yeah.
You know, you're not bringing a big hitter in the bunt. We all know why he's in there.
Right.
So I didn't need to know because that was the not important part.
Yeah.
Very hard to tell that to a young actor that the work is not important. It's the work that's important.
Right.
It's not what it is.
It's not what it is. It's that.
It is.
It's just doing it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of and course. That I didn't need to know. In fact, the more I didn't know, the easier it was.
Right.
Because I didn't overthink the fucking thing, which is the actor's nightmare. Thinking too much. Getting my actors not to think anymore It's really what's going to put me in an early grave.
Yeah.
Those 5 years I'm getting back for exercising, shot when you work for actors.
So yeah, so you were brought in because you had worked with her before, or she just knew your work and knew you could kind of do all the different voices and would run with it kind of thing?
Yeah. They knew what you could do and they broke in for it. You know, and then get out of Dodge. You know, sometimes you get actors, and I found this true with some voice actors. You know, actors don't want a line reading.
Right.
Actors don't want to be told that, you know, 14 years for Royal Shakespeare Academy and that. You walk in there with these preconceived notions of what do they want. I promise you, half the time, they got no clue what they want.
No.
But unless you show them you, the actors in the booth. They want to know, they want to be brilliant. Artists want to be brilliant.
Yeah.
Producers want it on time. So you get someone who's, you know, I don't need a line reading. I've been doing this 44 years. I was on, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, look, if I don't get the first time, given line reading, we don't want to get the lunch at 12:30.
Right, exactly.
It's not having an ego about. Have an ego that's healthy about, look what I'm doing, look what a contribution I can be to, thank you, sir, to my life, my career, my world. So don't be an idiot. Do the work, and guess what? They ask you back.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a schmuck. I'm fun to be around. I don't take this shit so seriously. And yet I want to do well.
Right.
That's not a question.
No, of course.
But it's not worrying how I'm doing.
Right. And also, like, I always find, like I say, one of the other things that I kind of get drawn to in the B-movie world or B-tier world or whatever you want to call it, and I don't necessarily love those labels, but we know what we mean. It's a good shorthand. So in that world is the opportunity to kind of do a whole bunch of stuff.
Right.
You're not stuck like your pal Bruce Willis. You're not stuck being, I have to carry a gun again and swear and make a wisecrack and kick down the door or whatever in every single movie I'm in. Like, no, he's diversified and done a bunch of other stuff, but in general, they want him to be John McClane in every movie. You, on the other hand, can be a whole... You weren't just Orville Ketchum, and I didn't mean to ever, like, label you.
No, because I'm that guy in the movies. I'm that guy that you really don't know. But didn't I see him in...
Right. You're that guy, which is the best guy to be.
I was the best guy, the working actor.
Yeah.
At 18, I wanted to be a star. At 63, I can look back and say, I became the man I said I would become.
Yeah.
Working as an actor. Sitting here telling stories that are true.
Yeah.
That are 45 years old. And that's bizarre to sit back and start looking back.
Right.
To realize, like I said before, more... yesterday's and tomorrow's.
Yeah.
More funerals than weddings at this point in my life. It's just part of the cycle, and you can either run scared from it,
right,
or you can slow the equation down even slower.
Keep them laughing as you go, right?
And just have a great time. My brother says, you talk to everybody. I go, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind, I need to plug something I'm working on.
Please do.
And I'm working with an amazing woman named Maggie Alexander. She's a producer and an actress here in New York. She's a company called Lung Tree Productions.
Okay.
Like it sounds, lungtreeproductions.com. And they brought me on board as a producer. And they're doing great stuff. What Maggie's idea is that art has to give back and make a difference in the world. And that... we're going to partner with a different charity for each production. She's done this in the past, and the production we're doing now that I'm co-producing is a play called Time Stand Still by Donald Margulies. They ran on Broadway about 6-7 years ago.
Okay.
And we're doing it in March at the Theater for New City in New York. 10% of all the sales for the tickets go to Physicians for Human Rights. It's a charity that helps people in war crime, in war-stricken areas, that combats war crimes, especially in Syria. This organization's been working a lot with stuff that we don't really realize that's going on. You know, we have to be cognizant of charities here and abroad.
Right.
And I know Maggie with the production is going to raise money. In fact, if you go to Lung Tree Productions, you can make a tax-deductible donation to the company. You can read about Maggie, about me. You can always contact me at either through John at the podcast here or peterspellos.com. But it's a terrific play about a photojournalist who returns to America from the war-torn areas and how she has to deal with relationships and how war changes everything.
And where are they putting the show on?
Theater for New City downtown in New York, here in the city.
Oh, nice.
And it opens in March, and I'll keep you posted on everything. But if you guys can get a chance to go to lungtreeproductions.com and check it out, we'd really appreciate it. Maggie's great. Maggie, I've directed her before on stage, and when she told me about this production, I said, I'm in, how can I help?
That's fantastic.
So this is how I'm helping.
And
right,
it's going to be a series, a long-running series.
Well, it's going to run for a month. The play is going to run for a month. It's
right.
Live on, again, at the theater, and who knows from there. Hopefully the plan is that I'll direct something come summertime.
Oh, nice.
Comedy, but we don't know yet. We're looking for plays. And
but the hope is that each play will be donating to a new cause.
Every play will have a different charity attached to it,
right,
and
right,
how
right.
they raise money. You can also go to a site called CharityNavigator.com if you ever want to know about your charity and where the money's going to. That's a great group. Charity Navigator.
Yeah.
Boy, you know, the coffee's kicking in right about now. You know, and I've been out with I haven't had my heroin in 8 hours, so it's really...
Yeah.
So thanks. And Maggie, I love you if you're listening.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Definitely everyone go over to Lung Tree Productions and support that out.
Aside from you and I can have a beer any time together, you haven't looked at your notes once.
No.
Which is fantastic because...
Well, because I said, yeah, first of all, we're having a fantastic conversation. And secondly, the nice thing about doing preparation, in other words, like saying that last night, some of it went in my head. So I knew I had to do Cowboy Bebop.
Right.
And I knew I had to talk about Orville Ketchum.
I had to use the notes about the show because I'm old and I forget the wrong date. And she'll smack me around. I don't want that to happen.
So, talking about Orville then,
all
just
right,
very
please.
Quickly, because we did Sorority House Massacre 2. Then you do the sort of unofficial sequel, which is Hard to Die.
We did the same movie on a different floor.
But it's unbelievably amazing. Like
Jim really let me go crazy in that.
When you fall from the top of the building and it makes it like Warner Brothers cartoon
Absolutely.
Noise and the camera shakes, I was just like, I'm in love with this movie.
The two bits Jim loved that when I'm walking through the thing and I just kind of grab the panties a little bit walking by,
he
looked
at
me like, oh, we're keeping that in. And the other bit where Orville's recovering, I said, I need a staple gun.
Yeah.
Because I knew that Orville was impenetrable.
Yes.
But if he got his finger caught, it would hurt.
It would
like
hurt.
Anybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I did the 1, 2, and the comedy 3 beat.
Yeah.
Like the first couple didn't matter.
Yeah, right.
But the one on the finger, you know, always hurt.
Yeah,
and that is my ode to Stan and Ollie and learning my lessons from 100 years ago.
Yeah.
That we could do a horror movie that Jim and I were the only ones doing. We were doing a comedy.
Right.
And we can add that level of...
When the boobs squeak, we know it's a comedy.
Right. When I'm doing Dinosaur Island and my hands are on Michelle Bauer's breast and I make this sound...
Yeah.
When it pops off, you know Jim gets it. But he grew
right.
up like I did, in New York City,
yeah.
with the same Abbott and Costello on Sunday mornings at 11:30. And that was the other thing that bonded us.
Yeah.
It's our love for Abbott and Costello. We could do lines from the movie. I knew it would always make him laugh.
Yeah.
If there was something on a set, I could go, hey, Jim, I just gotta do it. Can I do the scene just one more time? And the fact that I now am Facebook friends and talk with Chris Costello, Lou's daughter, on Facebook.
That's fantastic.
That I did American Dreams, and they were all shot on the sets of the sound stages where the Three Stooges were shot.
Yeah.
I got that I did movies on Warner Brothers and Paramount and Universal. I got to have a taste of that.
Yeah.
I have, and if Orville Ketchum is my legacy in show business, bless his plaid little heart.
Yeah, bless his flannel shirt.
Absolutely.
So one of the things I wanted to, just because I'm fascinated, when I spoke to Jim, he said that years later when he was doing one of his nudie films, that you showed up, you still had the shirt, and you're in the background somewhere, and he couldn't remember the name of the movie. Do you remember the name of the
movie?
No,
and if I did, I wouldn't tell you at this point.
Oh.
No, I have no recollection. But I was in that period where I wasn't working and I was having some problems. And and I came in, so I got the shirt. I said, yeah, of course I got it. Which is before I sold it, to get home. And I'm gobsmacked, if you will, by the love people have for Orville.
Yeah.
Well, my friends in Cleveland.
Because there's no other character like him.
At Cinema Wasteland, the Cleveland convention.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Terrific fucking people. Just
so my good friends, Tim Gross and Kyle Pollan, go to Wasteland all the time, and they absolutely love it up there. They used to do Horror Realm out in Pittsburgh. Okay.
Ken and his wife, and I'm lose her name at this point of my age. They're terrific people. They run a great event.
Yeah.
Charlie Fleming, who was responsible for bringing me in there.
I never got out to Wasteland because it's sort of been one of these days I'm going to go stay with Tim in Pittsburgh, and he's going to take me up to Wasteland one of these days.
Well, they keep threatening that they might bring me back to Wasteland, so we got to make sure it's the same year.
Definitely. Yeah, we've got to figure that out. Definitely got to figure that out. Because, of course, that's also where my other good pal on Facebook, who I've interviewed a bunch and who is just the loveliest guy, Tom Sullivan, he goes to Wasteland all the time with his Evil Dead Museum. And I've never met him, but I've talked to him like a whole bunch, and he's a wonderful guy. So
again, a rabid fan base of wonderful people who are even stranger than I am.
Yeah.
My stuff is in the comedy realm.
Yeah.
That's where my history and my strangeness goes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've been interrogated by Perry Mason, killed by Lois Lane, neuralized by Agent J.
We didn't even get onto Men in Black, too. Yeah.
Transformer. I mean, in the fantasy world, I've lived a very rich life.
Of course.
And the fact that I've got to be in, what would you call them? Lexicons, Uber, if you
genre
will.
Genre film.
Of this, the Guyver.
Yeah.
I did it.
Yeah. That's a wonderful thing. I haven't seen that in a long time. I need to rewatch the Guyver.
I mean, nowhere in cinema history will you see, but that movie, Michael Berryman, Peter Sellers, Jimmy J.K. Walker, and Spice Williams all together in one shot.
Michael Berryman, there's another fantastic guy. Such a sweetheart.
Sweetheart.
Completely.
But everybody, Brian Usna, who produced that movie, Steve Wang, Screaming Mad George as the directors. I've loved working with Guyver.
And we need to, Frank, I need to rewatch that movie, and we need to talk about the Guyver.
Absolutely.
It's a fantastic film. I haven't seen that in a long time.
They know it in England as Mutronics.
Right.
And so I just wound up signing somebody's Mutronics take back there.
We were laughing. This will make you laugh. So the Robert Redford movie just came out on Netflix, and it's called Our Souls in the Night. And I'm like, they better change that, because in the UK that would be Our Souls in the Night. So they better change the name of that.
And sadly, this country's not clever enough to catch that.
But when we saw that, Jim and I, we were like, are they serious with this? Assholes
in the Night. Assholes in the Night. Well, there's another thing. I can't spell S anyway but A-R-S-E now.
Right.
Well,
because it's a different word. Like, it's a completely different word. It's interchangeable with ass, but completely different word.
Right. It's the love of language and the history.
Yeah.
It's what I preach to my students. I made a reference one day, and I said, Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
And they said, who's Lenny Bruce? And I went, all right.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Class is over. Sit down.
Go figure it out.
Now we're talking.
Oh, okay.
I had to draw the Chris Rock, Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor. I had to draw the line for them.
Yeah.
How this each one birthed the next one. You gotta know from whence you came.
Definitely.
If I'm gonna be fat and funny, I better be studying Zero Mostel and Jackie Gleason and Laurel and Hardy.
Right.
I better know who did it better than I could ever dream of doing it.
Right.
The problem in this country is history is 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And now in society, more than anything else with social media, you guys have no sense of history. History in England starts with 1,000 years ago.
Right.
So you've seen it all 10 times. We think we know it all.
Right.
And I hate this entitlement.
We think we know it all as well, though.
But you have a right to think you know it all. You might have been a little too much with the missionary stuff.
Right.
But for the longest time, you did know it all.
Right.
The Royal Navy, everything.
But it was the cab driver that drove us from Brighton to Heathrow, because I was staying with my mum's at Brighton. He had been to New York for a week on vacation with his wife. He knew everything about New York. My God, did he know everything about New York. And he sat there for the whole journey. And I'm Uh-huh. And it was all this, like, ignorant tourist...
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much.
It was all this ignorant tourist stuff about New York that he had no idea. And I'm like, yeah, listen, dude, like, I get it, but I've lived there 9 years. Can we not do this right now? He's like, the taxi drivers in New York, they don't know where they're going, what they're doing. They've got no idea. And I'm like, listen,
dude. He must have nobody to bitch to.
Right, exactly. He just went on and on. I was like, okay, I get it. You're a taxi driver in England who doesn't use GPS. We all stand up and applaud you. And the fact that some taxi drivers in New York needed a cross street, that was his argument, that they needed a cross street, that was sending him apoplectic. And I was like, dude, you're going to have a heart attack. Yeah. You can't take shit that seriously. Tell him the fucking cross street and move on.
I think entitlement's going to kill this world.
Yeah. So I was saying, like, about history. So I was growing up, I can sort of draw a line when I went from being into Monty Python and the Beatles as being like the top thing, and then all the other people that kind of fall out underneath that, to then moving over to sort of like B movies and Tom Waits and other stuff like that.
Tom Waits.
But
we have the Tom Waits discussion.
Yes, let's.
The voice of my pain.
But. When I was a kid and I was into Python, or I was into the Beatles, which seemed like very populist things to be into, I would watch every documentary, read every book, because then I would find out about Beyond the Fringe. I would find out about... I would kind of go back to the Goon Show. Right. I would go back to all that stuff in the same way that when I got into stand-up, I would go back and I would find out about people like Lenny Bruce and Carlin and people.
You have to.
So I was always fascinated by that. One of the best things ever was the Beatles anthology, not because of the story they were telling, but because they would talk about their influences, and I was like, oh, I need to listen to that guy. I need to find out who Big Bill Brunsey is. I need to, you know, and I would go back and suddenly find out all these like little blues artists and rock artists, and that's what I love about it. You know, that's what I've always been drawn to, people who know stuff that isn't just that one thing. They know the history of where it came from.
We somewhere along the way, stories became visual and not verbal anymore. I can't blame it on technology. It is the technology. I'm in a visual medium. No one sits around and listens to people telling stories anymore. Yet there's slowly been, I think in the last few years, the movement, I think Russell Simmons started in that area with Def Comedy Jam. We started to get spoken word things started to happen. So Buddy Marty Kleinman is a terrific blogger and a novelist, writes about the Bronx and does these storytelling events. And I just think we stopped getting our information personally.
Right.
And we're now receiving it en masse, impersonally. So we believe everything because that's the only thing we're hearing. Because it's connected to a visual, too. We're hungry for that burger because Kate Upton's breasts are what we want to be putting between those buns that we see in the commercial.
Right.
We don't really want the burger. We want her bloody breasts on a bun.
Yes.
And by bloody, I mean English. I don't mean stabbed and cut in pieces, please.
No.
Oh, never mind. I just think the art of storytelling has been lessened.
Yeah.
And I think because of it, we communicate quicker to the world, but in less depth.
Yes. Well, that's why I love these conversations. That's why I like doing this show. Because, yes, we use a movie as a jumping off point, but then there's 100 other stories one can tell about personal experiences, about the thing that went into the making of the movie,
right,
about whatever it is. And art should inform other art, should inform other things. Like, it should all be part of it. I've long believed about even the silliest of things can teach someone something. Even
in fact, oftentimes the most silly things can teach something.
Yeah. The fish slapping dance might be the philosophical high point of our entire life.
Well, first, that they're half in coats and half in berets and mustaches. Isn't that the...
No, that's the sheep. That's the flying sheep.
Oh, that's the flying sheep.
The flying sheep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And hits them in the water.
The fishing...
Right.
Why are they dressed like colonial Brits with the pith helmet and the shorts? And why are they at Teddington Lock? And why do they have small pilchards and they're hitting them? And why does the other guy have an enormous fish? And
because
it doesn't matter.
Weird, because it's funny.
Yes.
Because... And there's no other answer than because it's funny.
Yeah.
And if you have to figure out why it's funny, move on. Oh, look, the door's open. Yeah. Move on and get out of here.
And get out of here.
We should move on.
Yes.
Because I feel bad we've been monopolizing this table. And then we're a lot of people outside.
Yes.
Let us... Get this out of the way?
Yeah,
let
we're
us
done.
Finally do that.
Thank you so
on.
Much. We're going to move on.
We've been doing an interview this whole time, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's
so
why.
Thank you so much, though. You were fantastic.
Thank
the
you.
Food was fantastic.
I'm glad you guys enjoyed it.
We plugged the diner and
we will plug the diner and, yeah, the Comfort Diner. What a place.
So there we go. As I said, the conversation just ends. There is no real kind of wrap-up. Peter and I went outside of the diner and had a further conversation along some of the sort of similar themes and got to know each other. And it's fantastic. There will be hopefully many more conversations with the man, the legend, Mr. Peter Spelos. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode and you want to be able to support the diner so that we can continue to bring you content like this, please do head over to patreon.com/aftermoviediner. And in fact, interviews like this, you will be able to get at least 24 hours early if you're a patron of the diner. There will also be exclusive content you will be able to get. There will be a whole separate podcast series you'll be able to download if you are a patron that no one else will be able to have access to. So please do check out patreon.com/aftermoviediner if you want to both support the diner and also get exclusive content. All right, so coming up now is the song all about Orville Ketchum, who is hard to die, and that is the Ballad of Orville Ketchum, and that can be found over on the Diner Ditties page at Diners Ditties, that's DinersDittiES.bandcamp.com. And on there you will find three albums, the Diner Jukebox, another Diner Jukebox, and the third Diner Jukebox, I think it's called, something like that. Yet another, sorry, Diner Jukebox. You'll be able to find all the songs from the Aftermovie Diner available either for purchase in album form or individual tracks. So if you like what you hear, that's another way you can go ahead and support the Aftermovie Diner. Each album, just $5. So incredible value for money if you like mad, stupid songs about your favorite films and actors and so on. Anyway, huge shout out to Peter, a huge shout out to the Comfort Diner in Midtown in New York. If you want to check out Peter, you can find him over at peterspelos.com or look him up on Facebook, Instagram. He's all over the place. Find Peter and tell him you love him. It's the least we can all do. All right. And now, Hard to Die, the Ballad of Orville Ketchum. Thanks for listening.
From the checks on his flannel shirt to the bristle of his mustache, his goggly eyes and slack jaw mouth all again. He's a hero to the few, the ones that really knew that to try and kill him was a terrible mistake. Well, he may look like he's the killer, all menacing and backward, but he's just trying to help in his own peculiar way. Well, it wasn't him, it was Crazy Hofstetter who committed all of the murders, yet just still trying to kill him and not let him have his say.
Well, it's lucky that he finds it hard to die, hard to die, hard to die, hard to die. Well, if you ladies had succeeded, well, I think I would cry. He's just another misunderstood, overweight guy. No need to keep trying to prove that all the ketchup finds it hard to die, hard to die, hard to die, hard to die. There's no need to keep trying to prove that with bullets and knives and throwing him off the roof, that all the ketchup finds it hard to die. In a sorority house or a lingerie store, no matter what you took your clothes off for, if you only realize he's the guy that you want on your side. Well, it's a Wynorski film, so you're not fully dressed, but it's your friend that Ketchum that's murderously possessed. And all of those slasher films you watch growing up, they basically lied. It's the hero, not the killer, that finds it hard to die, hard to die, hard to die, hard to die. Well, if you ladies had succeeded, well, I think I would try. He's just another misunderstood, overweight guy. No need to keep trying to prove that all will catch him finds it hard to die, hard to die, hard to die, hard to die. No need to keep trying to prove that with bullets and knives and pushing him off the roof, that all the Ketchum finds it hard to die. Catch him if you can, catch him if you can. It doesn't matter what you think you want, just catch him if you can. Catch him if you can, just catch him if you can. Doesn't matter what you think you want, just catch him if you can. Catch him if you can. Double catch him, so catch him if you can.